seated, please. The court is ready to hear argument in 110855 Nestle USA versus Susan Combs.
May it please the court, Mr. Nolan will present argument for the plaintiff, and Mr. Farrer will present argument for the amicus. Plaintiffs have reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Nolan will open with the first 15 minutes and will present the rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. With the court's permission, the amicus is going to address the jurisdiction. If there are questions about jurisdictions which are not answered, if I may, I'd like to address those in the 10 minutes I reserve for rebuttal. The current Texas franchise tax creates scores of different classifications of tax treatment. It uses different standards for total revenue, different standards for cost of goods sold, different standards for compensation, and different standards for ability to use the deduction. As a result, the franchise tax as a percentage of Texas profits differs between industry groups by almost 3,000%. The average effective tax rate for the five least taxed industries is less than 1/4 the average effective tax rate for the five most taxed industries. The question before this court today is whether the legislature may impose a tax, a franchise tax, which places such an unequal and disparate burden on Texas taxpayers when the franchise tax should be commensurate with the value of the privilege of doing business in Texas.
Why didn't you pay your taxes in protest?
We didn't pay our taxes in protest because under Section 24, there's no requirement to pay those taxes in protest in order to come to this court and challenge the constitutionality.
But you understand it's generally required, right?
It's generally required, and our point on this is the Section 24 doesn't say anything about a particular procedure you must go for. Mandamus generally requires that you ask a state official to do something, they turn you down, and then you ask for mandamus. It is not required when that would be a futile act. And in this case, that would be a futile act. The comptroller had been enforcing this franchise tax for years. ALCAT had come to you and challenged the franchise tax on the very grounds upon which we challenge them today, the equal protection and the commerce clause and the due process. The comptroller did not say, oh, I'm sorry, you're right, and stop enforcing the act. The comptroller got the AG and they fought against that. A month later, only a month later, we bring our action in this court. It would have been futile, it would have been a waste of time to go to the comptroller and say, we know that you are currently defending against these in the ALCAT case, but we've come to ask you to declare that this statute is unconstitutional upon the very grounds that you're fighting in the Supreme Court. So under those circumstances, the case law is relatively clear that if it's a futile act, you don't need to do that. And so that's why we did not ask the comptroller to declare these unconstitutional in any manner before we came to this court.
Or not just to ask her to declare it unconstitutional, but ask her to refund.
Refund, yes, Your Honor. And the refund sort of peculiar to the Section 112 procedure. So it's under that procedure, we did not ask for the refund. So the question is, if a tax should be commensurate with the value of the privilege of doing business, is what the legislature's done? Is that constitutional? And the state points out, and we agree, that mathematical precision is not required in determining the value of the privilege, but you at least have to try to determine the value of the privilege. The Austin Court of Appeals in the Bullock v. Sage case explains why, they don't really break any new ground, but they explain why a franchise tax, which is commensurate with the value of this privilege, must logically and constitutionally value this privilege by the same standard. The Sage case reiterates The franchise tax is one imposed on the value of the privilege to transact business in Texas. That's the standard by which we will measure this. It's the value of the privilege. The court starts with Article 8, Section 1 of the Texas Constitution, which says, taxation shall be equal and uniform. And then the court recites the logic of the Lively case. That's a property tax case. And the Lively versus Missouri case says, the standard of uniformity described by the Constitution being the value of the property, taxation cannot be uniform unless the value of all property is ascertained by the same standard. That's just logic. It's not law, it's just logic. Using this logic, what the Austin Court of Appeals says is, the standard of uniformity for a franchise tax, the value of the privilege, taxation, this franchise tax cannot be uniform unless the value of the privilege is ascertained by the same standard. They simply apply the logic from the property tax case to the franchise tax case, and precisely because both of them must be commensurate with the value of that which is being taxed. That's all the Sage Court did. We maintain that the Sage properly applied the Lively standards of uniformity to franchise taxes because the franchise tax should at least reasonably attempt to be commensurate with the value of this privilege. The state, by the way, does not contend that the classifications in the franchise tax are related to the value of the privilege, but instead argues that the myriad classifications which are used, which caused admittedly unequal treatment of taxpayers, are nonetheless rational because there's some other legitimate public policy, not tied to the value of the privilege, but some other policy. And that policy could be as simple as a desire to encourage a particular occupation or encourage a particular industry.
And does it always have to be tied to the value or the privilege?
In a franchise tax and in a property tax, yes. Or else it doesn't make any sense. If you have a tax which is commensurate, and I looked up the word commensurate in the dictionary, and it means proportionate. So if you have a tax which is proportionate to the value of that privilege, then you must measure that value the same for everybody, or how can you have a proportion?
And theoretically, could the other legitimate public policy be tied to the value or privilege? You just contend that it's not?
Yes, we just contend that it's not. And what's important is the state doesn't even pretend to contend that it is. It's simply not.
And wouldn't that value just fluctuate over time and over economic conditions?
Yes, Your Honor, it would. And the word I really like you used is economic conditions. The value does depend on economic conditions. These myriad distinctions don't. They're unrelated to economic conditions. They're unrelated to the value of the privilege. And that, we think, is the fatal flaw.
So how is that corrected? Do you have to hire a bunch of actuaries to come in and determine what that privilege is for each?
No, it's really relatively easy, and the state of Texas did it the easy way for 100 years, or however long there's been a franchise tax. What they did was they took something which was a proxy for that value. They might use income as a proxy for the value of the privilege. They might use the wealth, the assets of the corporation or the industry as a proxy for that value. Then what they did was they taxed based, the tax base was either the income of the corporation or the property of the corporation or some combination of those two. So what the state did for decades and decades and decades was tried to figure out the value of the privilege. They took some proxy for it. It doesn't have to be mathematically exact, but they just have to try. It has to be the point of it. And for decades, what the state did was they took some reasonable proxy for the value of this privilege, and then they taxed that value. Here, they haven't attempted to do that at all. That was what we say is the fatal flaw. They're not taxing the value. They're taxing something which is unrelated, and that's the fatal flaw in this. The Enron Corp case is instructive in our analysis. We both cite the case, both sides cite this case. And Enron was a property tax case questioning whether it was a violation of the Equal and Uniform Tax Clause to allow taxpayers to value petroleum reserves on different dates. I think one was September 1st of the previous tax year, and one was January 1st of the current tax year. And so the court, like other courts that have looked at this, started the analysis by examining the Constitution. Article 8, Section 1A provides that taxation shall be equal and uniform. Article 8, Section 1B provides that all real property and tangible personal property shall be taxed in proportion with its value. The Enron court also relied, just as Sage did, upon the reasoning in Lively versus Missouri for the proposition that what is now Section 1B, providing that property is in proportion to its value, actually secured, this is important, it secured the uniform and equal tax treatment of Article 8, Section 1A. B, which is the proportionality, secures the equal and uniform requirements of Section 1A. And as we said before, the Enron court quoted this from Lively. The standard of uniformity prescribed by the Constitution in 1B, I'm sorry, in 1A, being the value of the property, taxation can't be in the same proportion to the value of that property unless all the property is ascertained by the same standard. It can't be. The logic of this is unassailable. When you tax the value of something, and that tax must be commensurate with the value of that something, it cannot be. It's a mathematical impossibility that the tax be equal and uniform unless the value of the property is uniformly ascertained. Enron does provide that the legislature may constitutionally draw distinctions or classifications in the manner in which the value of the property is determined, but only so long as those classifications are rationally related to determining the value. For instance, in Enron, it was permissible to have different dates for the valuation of these petroleum reserves, precisely because either date was rationally related to determining the property value of those reserves. What the court said was it might even be a better way of doing these reserves if you did it sort of average of every month. But certainly it is rational to pick either September 1st of the preceding year or January of the tax year because these petroleum reserves differ in value. And so either date was designed to get to an accurate value. Therefore, either date could be used. And classifications which are designed to get to accurate values can be used. Classifications which are not designed to get to accurate values, but are designed for other purposes. Perhaps you want to favor dentists over doctors. Those in an occupation tax, fine. In a franchise tax or a property tax, not fine. You could not tax the home, or you should not tax the home of a dentist differently than you tax the home of a doctor. You ought to figure the value of their home the same. Most of the cases, not all of them, but most of the cases cited by the AG's office are federal cases. And so I read those federal cases, and under equal protection, we should still prevail, and this is why. In the case of Allegheny-Pittsburgh Coal Company versus County Commissioners, it's at 488 U.S. 336. It's cited in the Nordlinger case, which the state cites. The question before the United States Supreme Court concerned a West Virginia valuation of property. West Virginia Constitution and laws had what we have. Taxation shall be equal and uniform. All property shall be taxed in proportion to its value. In the West Virginia case, a county assessor basically did what they did in California and said, look, instead of doing that, I'm gonna assess these based upon the value at which you bought the property. Therefore, you had different valuations depending upon when you bought the property. The Supreme...
What's the impact if we declare this unconstitutional? What's the impact on the state?
The impact on the state is they'll go back and they'll have a tax which is constitutional. It doesn't stop any of the good parts that this tax has. It doesn't stop broadening the tax base. What it does stop is an unequal and non-uniform tax. The state is working on that right now. I bet they'd love to have guidance. It's probably why they put Section 24 in there. Look, tell us what our guidance is so we can get a tax. This is important.
What happens to all the taxes that have been paid under this plan?
There are we're asking for a refund, but as this court has done in other cases, it can say, look, no refund, we're going forward from here or out state, you've got X number of time to fix this.
Going back to Justice Lerman's original question, and you didn't pay the taxes under protest,
yes.
Correct?
That's correct.
You never asked a comptroller to refund tax. You say it would have been futile, so what's the point? Because of their arguments.
Yes, sure.
Finn and Allcat. But you're asking us to issue a writ of mandamus.
Yes, sure.
And I'm wondering, you haven't asked the comptroller to honor your alleged rights, and the comptroller hasn't turned you down because you haven't asked her.
That's right, Your Honor.
And without the denial of that right, you know, without her refusal to perform a ministerial act, how can a court, you know, wag a finger and mandamus her, order her to take action if she's never refused to do what you asked?
I'm relying upon the large body of case law that says you don't need to request that the officer take a particular ministerial act if it would be futile to do so. And in this case, there is no question that it would have been futile while she is fighting equal protection in the Texas Supreme Court to go to her and say.
And why not pay them under protest at least?
Paying them under protest would be necessary if we were going through other sections to protest. But as this court pointed out, Section 24 is an exception. It's not 112. It's something different than 112. And there's not a requirement that you follow the requirements of 112 in order to use Section 24.
So that means, going back to Justice Medina's question, that means anyone who has paid taxes under the franchise tax then would be free to file suit against the comptroller for refund of all those taxes that would not be barred by limitations, I presume. Whether they have paid it under protest, whether they've requested a refund or anything, they could just go to the courthouse tomorrow as soon as our opinion issued, if we were to follow your lead here. As soon as the opinion issues, they go to the courthouse, file these lawsuits all over the state, and there's no reason they can't, except they would file them where? Here or in the trial court or where?
All right. I don't know what the limitation period is on Section 24. It's not in there, and I'm sorry, I just didn't look at it to see what limitations would apply.
They could follow your lead, I guess, and file them all up here.
If this court ordered that the statute was unconstitutional and it ordered a refund of all the taxes of the taxpayers before this court, then yes, I think other taxpayers could come in and ask for that. If this court ordered that the tax is unconstitutional and said these are what the standards are, legislature fix it, and we're not going to order a refund, then no one else could come in and ask for a refund.
Say that again, I'm sorry, you lost me. So that last part.
If the court said the statute is unconstitutional, I'm sorry, yes, the statute is unconstitutional.
And we grant you relief. And tell her to give your money back or not?
No. In the second situation, you say, no, we're not.
Okay, just relief.
Just relief. Give you a declaratory judgment, an injunction, but we don't grant you any monetary relief. In that instance, no one else would come back in and ask for the monetary relief.
But how do we just grant declaratory relief without mandamus? We said in Allcat that the declaratory relief would be just simply to enforce our mandamus.
That's right. And the mandamus we're asking for is both the money back, but we're also asking that the court instruct the comptroller and the state. Let me say the state. You're instructing the state that they've got to fix this. If they don't fix this, then they're going to pay this. Then they're going to have to pay money back. In other words, you're going to give them a certain time, like you did in the school tax cases. You're going to give them a time by which they need to act in order to fix the problem.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Kevin.
May it please the court. The revised margin tax is unfair and unconstitutional, and this court can and should overturn it now. The legislature clearly wanted the court to consider the tax now, up front, and for good reason. For many small businesses like those that comprise the membership of NFIB, the tax is unfair, unnecessarily complex, and imposes disproportionately high compliance costs. Two NFIB surveys that we cite in our brief show the pernicious effects of this tax for small business and illustrate why it's important to NFIB's members to have the tax's constitutionality decided now, up front. These surveys show that because of this tax, our members' actual tax bills have increased, prices have gone up as a result, and hiring has slowed.
Keep in mind, if the plaintiffs win in this case, your members would sue as well.
Well, not necessarily. I think that
they don't want their money back.
Well, that assumes. I mean, I think what NFIB is primarily concerned with is getting an equal playing field so that all businesses in Texas are playing on the same playing field. Something like the old version of the tax, which applied equally to all people, this sort of earned surplus model that, and then applied.
How much money are we talking about that you say has been unconstitutionally collected over the since the tax was in place?
You know, I'm afraid Amicus doesn't have any information on that, Chief Justice.
I mean, is it millions? Is it billions? Or what are we talking about?
Again, I quite frankly, I'm sorry, I don't have an answer. I can try and investigate it. I think. One response is that the court can, and I think the court does have discretion to issue relief prospectively and not necessarily retrospectively, and perhaps if this were an appropriate case, the court could do that in deciding the case and not necessarily ordering a refund of all of the amounts that have previously been paid.
In your brief, you say that the taxes failed to live up to expectations. Why do we have to even consider that in our analysis as to whether or not this is constitutional?
Well, that's not a point that the tax is unconstitutional, right? Every tax that fails to live up to expectations is not unconstitutional. You're exactly right. But what it does show is that it's not achieving its purpose, and at the same time, it's actually producing a lot of very pernicious effects for our members. And these effects include disproportionately high compliance costs. They include unnecessary complexity and unfairness. And these, we think, these are symptoms of deeper constitutional problems of the nature that Mr. Nolan and the relators are talking about. So we raise that point just to draw the court's attention to the fact that it's kind of a red flag that there are problems here. And for instance, just talking about compliance costs, this tax requires a specific cost of goods sold calculation that's unique to this tax. It has nothing to do with the federal cost of goods sold calculation, and it has nothing to do with generally accepted accounting principles. It also has this maze of different provisions to determine what tax rate applies. All of that means that small businesses have to hire special Texas tax franchise tax specialists to help them prepare their taxes. And yet even the experts are confused. Our members are reporting audits are up, even when these professionals have been retained, and this means that our businesses who have a relatively lower absolute level of revenue are disproportionately affected by the tax, not just because of their tax bill, but just because it's so costly to comply with this tax. And again, that we think points.
We've been making that complaint about the Internal Revenue Code for years, and it seems that they just keep adding paper up there, so I'm not sure that affects the constitutionality, does it?
Sure. No. It's not an argument that it's unconstitutional, but it is, we think, a symptom that there is something wrong here, and it also signals to the court why it's so important to our members to have this decided now, up front, and that's what the legislature intended. The legislature wanted the court to decide these issues now for these reasons, and also because it didn't want this cloud hanging over the state's fisc, right? We have this cloud of uncertainty, and if the court adopts the state's arguments and sends a number of these claims back through the district courts to work their way up for years and years and years, well, this potential bill that you all are worried about, this tax bill that might come due if this tax is found wanting, well, it's just going to grow and grow and grow. And so that is why the legislature wanted this court to, and empowered this court to, in Section 24, address these issues now up front.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents and real parties in interest.
May it please the court, Mr. Kraft will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Relators have not properly invoked the court's jurisdiction because they have neither paid their taxes under protest nor filed a refund claim with the comptroller. Because of that omission, they have not satisfied the statutory prerequisite to bringing a suit to recover taxes from the state, and they have not established the requisite demand and refusal from a public official that is a necessary predicate to mandamus relief.
What is your response to their argument that it would be futile? Would have been futile?
Two responses. One, it would not have been futile. I don't agree that the claims they're advancing here are the same as the claims that were advanced by ALLCAT. ALLCAT was bringing as-applied challenges to the comptroller's interpretation of the tax. They have one claim like that. They're bringing both facial and as-applied challenges to applications of the tax for their as-applied challenges and to the tax as a whole. So it's not the same. Now, the comptroller can't issue a declaratory judgment that the tax is unconstitutional, but that doesn't mean it would be futile, because she can, for example, look at the taxpayer's protest and see if they've made a mistake about their liability. Perhaps the challenge deduction, they've got it wrong. That can be fixed, avoid the constitutional question. The comptroller has authority to interpret the tax code. She may interpret it in a way that avoids the constitutional question. Or, as this court pointed out in the Corsicana Cotton Mills case, she might agree with them and say, I think it is unconstitutional, I'm going to decline to enforce it. Those are all reasons why it would not be futile to go to her first. But more importantly, the legislature requires it. The legislature said in Chapter 112 that in order to recover taxes from the state, you have to either pay them under protest or bring a refund claim with the comptroller.
Mr. Kraft, how would that work? They'd file a lawsuit in Travis County District Court demanding a refund. The statute at issue here, giving us original and exclusive jurisdiction, says we have original and exclusive jurisdiction. So how do they then make the claims, constitutional claims, they're bringing, they were talking about today here in this court? They have two separate pending proceedings, or?
No, Justice Wainwright, they would not go to Travis County District Court. They would pay their taxes under protest with the comptroller. Then they could file a constitutional challenge in this court, just like ALLCAT did. That's what ALLCAT did. It paid its taxes under protest, and then it came here. That's how that would work. So,
what about the requirement to file in district court in Travis County? That's just not applicable in this context.
What the court said in ALLCAT is that Section 24 is not, as they have described it, a completely separate procedure to bring a constitutional challenge. This is what the court said. It said, first, that ALLCAT's constitutional claims, quote, is subject to Chapter 112 of the tax code. That's what the court said. ALLCAT's claim is subject to Chapter 112 of the tax code. Then the court said Section 24 is, quote, a specific limited exception to the provisions of the tax code that confer exclusive jurisdiction over suits such as ALLCAT's on the district courts of Travis County. So Section 24 just displaces that part of Chapter 112 that puts jurisdiction in Travis County and says, no, jurisdiction is here. And the court confirmed that later in ALLCAT when it was confronted with Section 112.108, which says you can't issue mandamus relief regarding the constitutionality of a tax statute. If they were right, the court simply would have said, that's Chapter 112, it doesn't apply. That's not what you said. You said that Section 24 is a more specific, later enacted provision that trumps 112.108. But it doesn't displace the prerequisites to suit, because there's nothing in Section 24 that conflicts with those provisions in Chapter 112.
If we were to determine, though, that demand would be futile, then would our jurisdiction be invoked if that was our conclusion?
The futility exception is an exception that applies to mandamus. I don't think this court can carve out an exception like that in the statute in Chapter 112. And indeed, it did not in ALLCAT. It said that ALLCAT's claims, their constitutional claims, remain subject to Chapter 112. And what's more is that if you say Chapter 112 just doesn't apply, as they have, you're not simply getting rid of the jurisdictional prerequisites. Justice Johnson, you hit on this. You're also getting rid of the limitations period, because that's where we get limitations periods for taxpayer suits, Chapter 112. Subchapter B, which applies to protest suits, and subchapter D, which applies to refund suits, incorporate by reference the 4-year limitations period for administrative claims from Chapter 111. So if you say Chapter 112 doesn't apply, not only are you going to have to withdraw something you said in ALLCAT, but you're taking away the limitations period, because there is not one for Section 24. So if in a few years this court were to hold some or all of the franchise tax constitutional, you wouldn't just be seeing refund claims for the last 4 years. You'd be seeing them going all the way back to the beginning of the franchise tax, January 2008. That can't be the law.
And where would all of those have to be filed?
They would have to be filed here.
Because we have original exclusive jurisdiction under the provision.
That's correct. Now, if they comply with the statutory prerequisites, as they must, what would likely happen is everyone would line up at the comptroller and say, this applies to us too, give us our money back. I mean, that's what has happened in the past when courts have held some aspect of a tax constitutional. Everybody lines up.
We could say, as we did in the school finance case, that the result was unanticipated and in an unusual situation, it should apply only prospectively. Why not here?
Because that's not in the nature of mandamus relief, and that's what this court said Section 24 is all about. What makes mandamus proper or necessary is that they're asking for their money back. And as Justice Johnson pointed out, the declaratory injunctive relief is only available just to ensure that the mandamus you issue is complied with. Now, aside from the fact that they have not either met the Chapter 112 requirements or made the demand and refusal that is the general rule for mandamus cases, the court lacks jurisdiction over their as-applied challenges. NSBMA's as-applied challenge is in substance a challenge to the comptroller's rule about what heavy construction equipment means. They say that that deduction is not available to them because they rent out cooling towers for use at construction sites, and so they don't get that deduction. But there's nothing about the language heavy construction equipment in the text of the statute that necessarily excludes that equipment. It's heavy, it's equipment, it's used at construction sites. In fact, they presumed it applied because they took the deduction. The reason, in fact, why they did not get that, why it was disallowed, was because the comptroller audited their return and said, your equipment doesn't qualify for the rule, the definition of heavy construction equipment. That's the comptroller's interpretation, and that is precisely the kind of challenge that this court said is outside of the scope of Section 24. Now, as to their other as-applied challenges, the court did not reach the question in ALLCAT of whether the legislature could give you mandamus jurisdiction over an as-applied challenge, challenging an application of the act independent of the comptroller's interpretation. But you flagged the issue. You said, assuming without deciding that Article 5, Section 3 lets the legislature confer original mandamus jurisdiction on this court, and then proceeded with the analysis. But reading Section 24 to cover those kind of as-applied challenges runs into two limits on the legislature's ability to confer original mandamus jurisdiction on this court. Those limits were set forth in footnote 6 of ALLCAT. One of those is that the court can't decide or can't exercise mandamus jurisdiction if there are material fact questions. And an as-applied challenge, by definition, is fact specific. It requires the development of a factual record. So if you say as-applied challenges are included, you're running the risk that you're going to have a exclusive jurisdiction over a case that you can't decide.
Well, could we appoint a magistrate or a special judge to hear the facts for the court? Is that possible?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the Constitution specifically limits the authority of this court to decide fact questions.
In appeals, but not in anything.
No, even in mandamus jurisdiction, the court has said that. Now, you do have authority under section.
Well, the court said that, but the Constitution doesn't, right?
Well, I think the court has read that as a limit emanating from the Constitution, because Article 5, Section 3 does say you can decide factual questions related to jurisdiction, and you've so held. So that would be a reason not to construe this to cover as-applied challenges. The other limit that's pertinent that was recited in footnote 6 of ALCAT is that, and again, the court has said this emanates from the Constitution, is that there must be some strong and special reason for the exercise of this extraordinary jurisdiction. And the court said that's met when a case involves questions which are of general public interest and call for speedy determination. Well, an as-applied challenge, by definition, is not one of general public interest because the relief is specific to that taxpayer. So that's another limit on the legislature's authority to do what it did in Section 24. You can avoid that problem by construing Section 24 only to apply to as-applied challenges. Now, I do want to turn to the merits of their claims.
Wait, excuse me, just a second. Sure. Did you say construing Section 24 to apply only to as-applied or to not apply?
I'm sorry if I misspoke. To apply only to facial challenges. Facial challenges would not run into that limit because they would be some structural defect in the Act, as in ALCAT. Now, on the merits, relators have failed to overcome the robust presumption that the franchise tax is constitutional. Their equal and uniform claim fails because it depends entirely on appropriating a constitutional requirement that applies only to property taxes. And as their reply brief and their argument today reveals, they really don't have a response to the comptroller showing that their federal claims lack merit. Now, on equal and uniform, they're relying on a standard that applies only to property taxes. And I want to give you the constitutional provisions that frame this discussion. In Article 8, Section 1A, we have the general provision that says taxation shall be equal and uniform. In 1B, the provision is all real property and tangible personal property in this state shall be taxed in proportion to its value. And then Section 2A says all occupation taxes shall be equal and uniform upon the same class of subjects within the limits of the authority levying the tax. So for taxes other than property taxes and occupation taxes, the only limit in Article 8 is that general provision that they have to be equal and uniform. So the question is, what does that mean for the franchise tax? They're relying on the Lively case. That's a property tax case. And the reason why Lively came out the way it did was because they were relying on that specific language that is now in Section 1B, that property must be taxed in proportion to its value.
But don't you think that the taxation should be fair and equally distributed amongst the taxpayers, whether it's a franchise tax, an income tax, or otherwise?
What the court has said that equal and uniform means as to a franchise tax is simply that it must have some rational basis. And as long as the legislature has some plausible policy reason for doing that, that's okay.
The policy reason is good here, but you have one business that's taxed at a 400% tax rate, another at a 5% tax rate. I mean, that doesn't seem to be equitable.
That is equitable under the proper standard because the legislature has authority to draw those distinctions between businesses. and it can favor one business over the other, and that will result in a different tax burden for some businesses and not for others. So that is a decision for the legislature.
Okay, so we're not to look at the tax burden on the small businesses here. We just look at the result. Is that what you're saying?
Well, first I'm going to take issue with the argument that this is somehow targeting small businesses. What Mr. Ferrer didn't point out is that there's an exemption for the franchise tax for businesses that have $1 million or less in total revenue or would owe $1,000 or less in franchise tax. So I don't agree that this is an anti-small business tax. But in terms of the looking at the outcomes, no, you don't look at that. You just look and see if there's a plausible policy reason for the legislature to distinguish one kind of business from the other, and a difference in businesses is enough.
Doesn't it have to relate to the privilege of doing business?
Two responses to that, Justice Heck. First, I want to talk about this language that they're relying on. It has to be commensurate with the value of the privilege granted. Where does that language come from? It's been recited by this court in cases such as General Dynamics versus Bullock, but if you go back through the case law, it comes from an old writ refused case, United North and South Development versus Heath. And what the court said in that case was it looked at the franchise tax formula that was then in place and said, it's apparent to us that the purpose of the legislature in enacting this franchise tax was to impose a tax on the value of the privilege of doing business in Texas. What they're trying to do is to take that judicial observation about the old franchise tax and spin it into a constitutional limitation on the new franchise tax. It's not. There's actually nothing in Article 8 about a franchise tax. So it can be for whatever the legislature wants it to be, subject only to that general provision that taxation must be equal and uniform. In fact, the only thing the Constitution says about...
It seems to me that leaves nothing to equal and uniform. It seemed to me that your argument says a rational basis or a plausible basis just means whether rational people could think it up. And of course, that is what happened here. But if it has to be rationally related to something that you can tax, like the privilege of doing business, then it seems to me it's a much harder argument to make.
Two responses to that. First, what the correct standard is, which is the standard under equal protection, and I'll address that in a minute, the relationship just can't be so attenuated as to render the tax irrational. So that gets back to the rational basis standard. Second response is, you're right. Almost everything will meet that standard because it is a highly deferential rational basis standard. Indeed, this court said in Enron, it's even more deferential when you're talking about tax classifications.
So the state could decide to fund public education, a laudable goal, that all of the billions of dollars needed will come from the 100 largest companies, the 100 largest companies operating in Texas, and the other tens of thousands or more will not be taxed. Whether it's good or bad policy, you can argue that. Is it constitutional? Sounds like you would say yes.
I would say yes.
Or could get it all from one company.
Well, I mean, that might run into other constitutional problems, such as
but as for Article 8 and the equal and uniform provision, you would say, yes, the state could do that.
Yes, the state can do that. I'll give you an example of something that wouldn't meet the test, Justice Heck. The MetLife versus Ward case from the U.S. Supreme Court, that's at 470 U.S. 869. There, Alabama imposed a higher tax on insurance companies because they were incorporated, that were incorporated out of state. So you could have two insurance companies, they're doing the same business in Alabama, one pays a higher tax simply because it's incorporated in Delaware rather than Alabama. But every time someone brings one of these challenges, they almost always fail because it is a deferential standard. And getting back to the other point I wanted to make about commensurate with the value of the privilege, even if we accept that that is a purpose of the franchise tax, or even the main purpose of the franchise tax, it's not the exclusive purpose of the franchise tax. It doesn't have to be. Indeed, that's something that the U.S. Supreme Court pointed out in the Fitzgerald versus Racing Association of Central Iowa case cited in our brief. This is what the court said. Tax laws, quote, might predominantly serve one general objective while containing subsidiary provisions that seek to achieve other desirable, perhaps even contrary, ends as well. So it's fine for the legislature to say, our general goal here is to impose a tax on the value of doing privilege in Texas, but they can achieve other goals, even contrary goals, through the exclusions, classifications, deductions, exemptions that are challenged here today. They might say, for example, one of the distinctions that's being challenged here is that there's an advantage for the compensation deduction for businesses that use employees vis-a-vis employees who use independent contractors. Well, the legislature might say, we want to give a tax advantage to businesses that create jobs, that provide benefits for Texans. And so we're going to give them a tax advantage that we don't give to companies that just use independent contract labor. That's a perfectly permissible goal, and there's nothing about there's nothing in the Constitution that precludes the legislature from trying to achieve that through the franchise tax. But I want to go back to what is the proper standard under 1A. It's not Lively, because that's a property tax case, and it deals with that language in 1B that applies only to property tax. The central authority you should look to is the Enron case. Enron versus Spring ISD noted that property taxes are subject to that constraint in 1B that tax be in proportion to value. But then the court said there is no similar constraint on occupation, use, excise, or sales taxes. Well, a franchise tax is a type of excise tax. So there you have it. You said that that constraint on property doesn't apply to a category of cases or category of taxes that includes the franchise tax. The other significant thing you said in Enron was that the requirements of Article 8, Section 1A, the Equal and Uniform Clause, are similar to the Federal Equal Protection Clause. And you said those cases provide guidance. And then you cited the Nordlinger versus Hahn case, and you quoted it. You quoted it for the proposition that equal and uniform and equal protection are satisfied so long as there is a plausible policy basis for the classification, and that standard is especially deferential in the context of classifications in tax laws. There's another case not cited in our brief that also is relevant here, and that's the State versus Hogg case. It's 72 Southwest 2nd 593. It's an opinion adopted case from the Commission of Appeals, so it's treated as an opinion of this court. That was a challenge to the state inheritance tax. And that inheritance tax drew classifications that charged different rates to different classes of persons. And much like the relators here, the challengers in that case said, that tax has to be in proportion to value, because what you're taxing is the value of the property that's inherited. So those classifications are unconstitutional under equal and uniform. And this court said no, because the inheritance tax is not a property tax. It's a privilege tax. And because it was a privilege tax, the court said the challenge classifications, the validity of those challenge classifications are, quote, free from doubt. So again, the court drew that distinction between property taxes and everything else. The other line of precedent I want to point you to on this are the courts of appeals, because the courts of appeals have entertained equal and uniform challenges to the franchise tax. And almost all of them have applied this deferential rational basis standard. Many of these cases are cited in the briefs. The Grayson County State Bank versus Calvert case, cited at page 27 of our merits brief. Rylander versus Palais Royal, Rylander versus Three Bill Brothers Three, cited at page 12 of their merits brief. Rylander versus B&A Marketing, cited at page 8 of their reply brief. And another case no one cited, Southwestern Bell Telephone versus Combs. That's at 270 Southwest 3rd, 249, an Amarillo Court of Appeals case from 2008. All of these courts applied this deferential, rational basis standard when looking at an equal and uniform challenge to the franchise tax. The one outlier is this Sage Energy case, and not surprisingly, that's the case they hang their hat on. Sage Energy is simply wrong, and I disagree with Mr. Nolan that Sage Energy engaged in some sort of logic, some sort of analysis to tie the standard for property taxes to the franchise tax. What Sage Energy did was it cited the language in 1A and 1B. It used to all be in one paragraph. They just quoted that language, and then they cited Lively. They cited the Lively case, which we know is a property tax case that depends entirely on 1B. And it said, you know, it cited the standard, the proportion in value, and then it just applied that to the franchise tax. There wasn't any reasoning why they would make that leap. They just did it. They made a mistake. That case is wrong because the language that Lively turned on, that proportion to value language, only applies to property taxes. And that's what Braden has concluded. Braden has looked at this issue in his treatise on the Texas Constitution. And what he determined, and I'm quoting from page 568 of his treatise, "The law is that equal and uniform does not prohibit reasonable classifications in the case of any tax except the property tax. As for property, the law is that all property must be taxed at the same ad valorem rate." And then later on page 570, same thing. "All property must be taxed equally and uniformly in proportion to its value. All other taxation must be equal and uniform, but the legislature may classify the objects for taxation so long as the taxation is reasonable." Now, beyond that precedent from this court and Texas courts and Braid's analysis, we looked at other states. There are five other states that have what I call standalone equal and uniform taxation clauses, where they're just saying, like Texas's constitution, taxation shall be equal and uniform, and they don't tie it to a particular tax. Those states are Mississippi, Nevada, South Dakota, West Virginia, and Wisconsin. All of those states interpret that equal and uniform taxation clause in the same manner that the U.S. Supreme Court interprets the Equal Protection Clause, and that is this highly deferential, rational basis standard. If you expand that inquiry to all the states and look at any equal taxation clause they have, or even their equal protection clauses, only three states have said that they will apply that equal taxation clause or equal protection clause more rigorously than the federal government applies the equal protection clause to tax laws. Those states are Iowa, Illinois, and Utah. And only Iowa has actually done it. Only Iowa has actually applied its tax equality clause more rigorously to strike down a tax. So because the standard is just this very deferential, rational basis standard, and because the legislature can accomplish any other goal it wants to in the franchise tax, it doesn't have to be tied to the value of the privilege granted by the legislature. It can be for other purposes as well, as long as we can come up with a plausible policy reason for doing so. They haven't engaged on that because they know they're going to lose under that federal standard. What they want to do is move the goalpost and say that there's a heightened standard for the franchise tax and that you should treat it just like the property tax, but that's not what the law says. Unless there's any questions about the due process or Commerce Clause claims, because they didn't address those in the reply brief and they didn't address them here today, the Comptroller will stand on our briefs for those claims and ask that the court dismiss this case for lack of jurisdiction or deny relief.
Thank you, Mr. Kraft. The court will hear rebuttals.
Mr. Nolan and ALLCAT, the relators, all satisfied the Chapter 112 requirements. Nobody disputed the applicability or the application of Chapter 112. And the state rather forcefully says that your failure to abide by those prerequisites is jurisdictionally fatal. And we did say in ALLCAT, there's a passage where we said that suits under Section 24 are subject to Chapter 112 of the tax code. And you say what?
We say, Your Honor, say two things. One, you said in there that Section 24 is an exception. And that...
And you interpret exception to mean...
That you don't
completely
have
...completely supplant, like establish a totally new comprehensive regime for taxpayer suits.
Right, that there's no need to go through the requirements of 112 and have this same case in two different courts in order to take advantage of Section 24. We said that was not, that would be a very unusual concept. I don't know that that's ever been employed in Texas law before.
I'm just trying to figure out what in the act suggests that lawmakers intended to create a whole new regime and to supplant all the prerequisites of Chapter 112
for all purposes. We read the words original and exclusive to answer your question. When it said this court has original and exclusive jurisdiction over this narrow challenge, and the reason for that is, there's a very good reason for that. As everybody has pointed out from the questions from the bench, what about the dollars involved? As counsel for the state pointed out, this is an extraordinary remedy. What the legislature said is, this needs the extraordinary remedy of going to the Supreme Court, because if you work your way through the district court and the appellate courts and come to the Supreme Court years later, then whatever the magnitude of that problem, whether it's tens of dollars, millions of dollars, billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, it will be that much greater by the time you get here. It is imperative, not necessarily from a legal standpoint, but the legislature, and we at least think, it is imperative that the legislature have the guidance of this court. They are begging for it as they now work on changing the franchise tax. This is so much better time to give them that answer.
If we agree with you that Chapter 112 doesn't apply here,
yes.
I assume your argument is that Section 24 is itself a clear enough, unambiguous enough waiver of immunity that you would get your tax refund.
Yes, Your Honor. Can I address a few things from what counsel for the state said? I don't know that he did this on purpose, but he misquoted the Enron case. The Enron case says the legislature's authority to make classifications in levying occupation and sales taxes. And he added in the word excise. But my copy of the case does not have that word in here. So, and it's true, you've got two different types of constitutional provisions. You have the occupation tax constitutional provision, which says you can make classifications. It says you can make classifications for any reasons you want. All we require is that within the classifications, you treat people equally and uniformly.
The Enron case does two sentences further down say there is no similar constraint on occupation, use, excise, or sales taxes.
That's right. And Your Honor, in this, well, but I apologize. That's my mistake. I don't know that the franchise tax is an excise tax.
I think it is a franchise tax.
We have all these cases that say it's not a property tax, it's not an income tax. An excise tax is like a tax on sale on cigarettes or something, and that's not really what this is. So you really have something which has not been addressed by the courts. This, we write on a bit of a blank slate on the franchise tax. How are we going to treat the franchise tax? The Court of Appeals cases, which counsel mentioned, most of those cases use sort of general language, we've got to have a rational basis, but then tie that rational basis to the value of the privilege of doing business in Texas. For instance, in the Central Power and Light Company, it was tied to the value of capital equity. In the Sharp versus Caterpillar, the deductions were rational because an economic reason tied to the value of the company. In the Rylander B&A case, it was tied to capturing benefits provided by the state. Universal Frozen Foods is just like Rylander versus Three Beal Brothers. The difference in the calendar treatment was okay, but that's because it was the taxpayer's choice as to which calendar date they were going to pick. Everybody was treated equally. These appellate cases, the lower court cases, do not stand for the proposition that this tax is not commensurate with the value of the privilege. Nobody says that. No court in 100 years has said that. When you ask that question, well, what does equal and uniform mean? This court has issued opinions saying deductions and exemptions and changes are an anathema to equal and uniform. That is what this court has said. They are an anathema to equal and uniform. And in the franchise tax arena, because it should be taxing the value of the privilege of doing business in Texas, it is an anathema to that, to have all of the myriad exceptions, exemptions, deductions. You can take this deduction, you can't take this deduction. They take it completely away from valuing the privilege of the business of doing business in Texas. If I can briefly address our other two constitutional arguments, the due process and the Commerce Clause, they kind of go in with this same theme, and that is it's got to be somehow related to the privilege. Under the due process, we're complaining because we take one example. Texas franchise taxes wholesalers who sell their own products at 1% and wholesalers who sell other products at 0.5%. We say that's a violation of due process. And the due process analysis says, due process requires the taxing power exerted by a state bear a fiscal relation to benefits given by the state. Even under due process, you just can't be willy-nilly. It has to bear some fiscal relation to the benefits given by the state. The state points out Nestle's a unitary business, therefore the state may determine the appropriate tax base in Texas by doing three things. You define the scope of the business, that means for Nestle, it'd be both their in-state wholesaling and their out-of-state manufacturing. Plus everything else they do out-of-state. You determine the total income from all the parts of the business, and then you apportion the income between Texas and the rest of the world. You can use any objective measure. In our instance, it uses a ratio of Texas gross receipts to total gross receipts in the world, and that's the portion that comes to Texas. The state says that this court has approved this approach because it better approximate a unitary business's value. The unitary business principle does a better job of accounting for the many subtle and largely unquantifiable transfers of value that they place among the components of a single enterprise. The state says apportionment better approximates the value of the wholesale activities of Nestle in Texas, taking into account the transfer of value from outside of Texas that increases Nestle's benefit that it gets from Texas. You do all these things outside of Texas, they increase the benefit that you get in Texas. We're taking that into account. Thus, the state argues, apportionment works to arrive at a rational fiscal relationship between the benefits given by Texas to the wholesale activities of Nestle within Texas. And because of apportionment, Nestle will pay on a larger tax base than if you just looked at what they did in Texas. Now, citing the Grossjohn case, the state points out that because a unitary business's out-of-state operations affected the value of its Louisiana business, and thus the value of its privilege to conduct business in Louisiana, the legislature may rationally take the out-of-state operations into account in assigning the tax rate. So he says, look, you can do both. However, the stores in Grossjohn had not already had their tax base jacked up to reflect out-of-state activity. There was no apportionment in that case that already raised their tax base. So what Louisiana did is said, we're going to make it fair by changing the tax rate. They didn't say, we're going to make it fair by apportioning, and then we're going to double it.
Well, a quick question. Chapter 112, which I know you believe does not apply at all.
Yes, sir.
But Chapter 112 has a pretty express, clearly defined mechanism for recovering already paid improper taxes.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's no such regime or system set up explicitly within the Act. But you say there's no problem with that, that it's sort of implicit?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, I think this court has said, in order to enforce our mandamus authority, which we have, we can take those actions necessary to do that. And yes, I would think that would be implicit in the...
The fact that the Act gives you permission to sue and allege a constitutional violation, you believe kind of embedded in that is authorization, that itself is an appropriate sort of waiver of immunity and permission to recover you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And may I follow up?
Yes, Mr. Chief? Justice.
And just follow up and make sure, if we simply take the Act, the grant of exclusive jurisdiction in this court, and we disregard chapter the tax code prerequisites and limitations and all of that, then it seems like do you have any answer about what there would be a limitation on, any limitation anywhere that you find as far as time period for anyone to file suit in this court alleging a constitutional violation and requesting all of their money back? Is there any limitation on who could do that time-wise or otherwise that you see?
I haven't looked at that, Your Honor. I imagine you'd go to the Civil Practice and Remedies Code or something appropriate and look for the limitations provisions which relate to that, which is not
just
specific.
A general limitations provision.
But that's just off the top of my head, Your Honor.
And then whether they alleged it was an as-applied or facial challenge or whatever, they're all going to file in this court because they may not have paid under protest. Well, if they didn't pay under protest, there's nowhere else they could go, so they would be coming here, I presume. Would that be a fair conclusion?
If this court ruled that it was unconstitutional and that people get their money back, then I don't know if they'd file in this court or this court would set up some other mechanism. But if you said it's unconstitutional, you get your money back.
You get your money back.
Then it would only be fair that people get their money back. I don't think this court, speaking of equal and uniform, would say you people get your money back, you people don't get your money back, because that wouldn't be equal and uniform.
Unless they were as applied challenges with factual determinations in there?
Perhaps. And ours, we say, are not as applied, by the way. They're not just strictly as applied. Everything that we've alleged applies to numerous people. There aren't any specific facts. I haven't argued one fact in here I needed to establish. They haven't disputed one fact.
Your time was up, and I didn't mean to
I'm sorry,
get
Your Honor.
Into a whole other area.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and that concludes the arguments for this morning. The marshal will adjourn the court.
Rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable. The Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.